Welcome to Betting 360, your number one source for horse racing and sports betting insights. Coming around the bend is your host, David Duffield, with another expert interview to give you the winning edge.
Hi, this is David Duffield, and welcome to part two of the Drupus and Vince Accardi episode of the Betting 360 podcast. So if you didn't hear last week's edition, there'll be some links on the website to listen to that. If you did, we're just going to pick up right from where we left off and run through the final set of questions from Drupus and get Vince Accardi to cover those in a bit of detail. Question number nine. Race leaders race with a few advantages. They control the race pace, they avoid forward interference and minimise lateral interference, and in the case of a solo leader, can run on the rail to minimise distance travelled. Statistical data shows the following pattern. Midfielders win more than backmarkers, on-pacers win more than midfielders, but leaders do not win more than on-pacers.
That's right.
Given the advantages that leaders enjoy, what explains this apparent anomaly?
But usually, I guess it's a little bit like a competitive athlete. If you can stalk your competitor and you can mould into their race shape, and hopefully that race shape is of a softer nature, then that could technically give you an advantage. And then I also apply this in horse racing. But also what it means is sometimes the horse is sitting in second position is actually controlling the race and not the leader. Because that horse, if it's of a superior quality to the leader, then what happens is the horse that's sitting in second place can stalk that leader, but also keep all its competitors behind it at bay, whether it be inside him or outside him, and that therefore having a level of control because it has superior class in terms of its speed capability to be able to win the event, and it can be very apparent very early. But from the leader's point of view, unfortunately, unless you get onto certain tracks where they're very heavily leader biased, or on a race day where that can be a tremendous advantage, yes, leaders do not win very often. And it's not because, I guess, a runner is lacking of ability, because we've seen some of the greatest horses of all time be able to do that, and that's horses like Might and Power, as an example, who could just lead all the way and compound the competition into the ground through sheer speed. And we also see a horse like Vaux Rogue, which would be another runner that could go to the front and just absolutely compound the competition. And there's been many others as well, but they are in the minority, and a lot comes to do with the lead speed. Is the challenge is the rider sometimes more than the horse. The ability to be able to manage on pace is a skill within itself, and particularly leading. So I would attribute a lot of it to the rider, and then the capacity of the racehorse's athletic and aerobic capability.
Yeah, and we touched on aerodynamics before. That has to play a part. I mean, if you look at cycling, whether at a velodrome, the Olympics, or the Tour de France, you can see the suck run. They're getting cover, they can just peel out and come over the top of them. And so surely that applies to horse racing.
And we've seen in many situations, the Moody Valley, when the rail's out a fair bit, they get to the front, they have just tremendous advantage. And it's just it's the contour of the track, camber of the track, can all of a sudden give themselves a 2-3 lengths advantage. So therefore, the horses behind them have to probably work, instead of working, say, 0.3 or 0.4 of a second fast, they've now got to work like a second quicker to come right over the top of them. And we've also seen those situations at Randwick when the rail's been out 8 metres. It's almost impossible to get past them.
Yep. And I had a very successful punter on the podcast pretty early on, and he said he was willing to talk about most things, but that was actually something that was off the record, the aerodynamics of it all, because he thinks that it gives him an edge. So he's obviously studied that in a lot of detail.
Ah, for sure, no doubt.
Okay, question number 10. This is a horse-specific one, so hopefully you've got your computer fired up there.
Yep.
Fort Sumter, trained by Pat Farrell. This horse has run third, first, and first at its last three starts. The two wins were at big odds over the 1,200 metres at Warwick Farm. Prior to that run, it had been beaten almost 12 lengths over 1,200 metres at Rose Hill. I'm interested in what sectional data indicates about the pacing of that Rose Hill race, given the slow six track, and specifically, what does Fort Sumter's data indicate that might have allowed a consumer of daily sectionals reports to make a reasonable excuse for that horse's poor performance?
Yeah, well, I guess what I'd probably like to do with that is I'd probably need to spend some time analysing that, and it would be unfair for me to talk about that in great detail unless he was the owner of the horse.
Yep, and I deliberately haven't given you any of these questions in advance because I just wanted to get your immediate response.
I'd probably be very happy to give some intricate details. I probably feel uncomfortable to discuss that in detail about the horse because I'm not saying that I would or wouldn't offend people, but I feel that that's very, very specific horse, singling out one horse, and that's probably not a good thing to do. But I'm happy to provide information to that person if he's the owner of the horse.
So in general terms, and if you're talking about a horse that's been beaten, you know, a dozen lengths and then comes out and wins, what would be some of the indicators you'd be looking for? Is it, I'm pretty sure you're going to mention race pace and fitness as a couple of
factors. That'll be very important aspects for sure. There's no doubt about that. That'll play a very important role. And then, and also, one of the things that we don't sort of talk about a lot is the mid-race exertion. That, particularly for horses that are fresh in their campaign, if there's a big mid-race surge, that can have a catastrophic impact on their finishing capability because they're running along, they're not rock hard in terms of race fit, and then they find themselves where they've been asked for like a massive exertion of speed, which sometimes could involve like a 2 second increase in race pace. And that actually, if that happens mid race and there's still 400 metres, they will be in a situation by the time they got to the 400, they're on empty, they'll be full of lactic acid, and they'd be crawling to the line and therefore making their run look far inferior than what it really was.
Okay. There's another horse-specific question here about Intimate Moment, trained by Ron Quinton. It says, four start to go, one over the mile at Warwick Farm in a pedestrian time. Subsequently, has won two of three starts and the latter was in a Group 3 at a big price. What does sectional data show about the Warwick Farm run, that was the 1,600-metre win, that might indicate the win was stronger than the race time indicates? Alternatively, would a race like that slip through the net in regards to spotting a strong performance?
Okay. So just Intimate Moment was the horse that you were saying, referring to,
And four starts ago, the mile win at Warwick Farm was in a pretty slow time.
Okay. Well, this is the thing, I guess, with a lot of horses as well. Race pace also governs, to a large extent, their capability of where they're going to finish in a race, because some horses don't have fast acceleration when they need to just quickly sprint, and they're a lot more one-paced, or they have limited capabilities on how fast they can accelerate. And this is that definitely comes down to the quality of the horse. And then you'll have other horses where they have just got a high cruising speed and they can run at that speed for long distance, and that long distance could be for a sustained 600 or 800 metres, which is a long way in a race where many horses only possess a 200 or 400 metre sprint, and they have degreeing levels of that sprint as well, which makes it quite challenging. So I guess the genetic breakdown of that would play a big role in terms of what would have happened to them. Now, as for Intimate Moment and looking at that, do you have the date of that last run?
Okay. It says four runs back.
Doesn't help me a lot.
Fair enough. All right, we'll keep moving then. Question number 12 is a four-parter, and it's to do with a chat you've had with Racetrack Ralphie, the old Weekly Waffle. Part A is, weight is all about, this is a quote from you, weight is all about thresholds as opposed to what they're carrying. That was the end of the quote. Drufus says, that's not correct. The effect of increasing weight is linear. There is no magic number in kilos beyond which a horse just cannot win. That's one of the myths of Australian racing. An article, The Impact of Weight on the Performance of a Racehorse, explains how weight affects running times. Presumably, you would suppose the author of that article is incorrect, and if so, how?
Well, that's interesting, Rufus, about the word, the myth and all that. This is very interesting. I find it fascinating when people say things like that. Threshold of weight is a very important aspect. And when we talk about threshold, we need to understand threshold of weight. Under what circumstances? If you're a small horse and you go from 50 kilos to 60 kilos, can you carry? Of course you can carry, because you may already be weighing 400 kilos, so now you weigh 410 kilos. It comes down to the rider and the way they use the balance of their weight. How is the rider carrying lead or not carrying a lot more lead? What's the situation there? Threshold, in terms of weight, plays a massive role in the exertion of speed for a horse. If they're in a fast run race or a slow run race, has a dramatic impact. So the threshold of weight is extremely important. So I'm not certain that that's not the case. From all my studies, that is very, very important and a very specific skill. And if one understands that in a lot of detail, they would have tremendous advantages. As I've seen many, many horses, which I'm not willing to disclose in detail, about the threshold of their capabilities, that when they have weight-changing situations under certain circumstances of race shapes, it dramatically impacts their performance.
All right. What about unlucky runs? Part B was if a horse is blocked or checked in a 1,200-metre race and you ask, so what happened to the other 1,150 metres?
Yes.
That was the quote. Drufa says, what happened is that the runner ran well enough to finish within a fraction of a length of the winner. He believes that exaggerating the effect of being blocked or checked isn't good, but neither is ignoring it. Why go from one extreme to the other?
Well, in the long term, when we look at a long-term philosophy and the measurement of class of a horse, because ultimately that's what it comes back to, and understanding their capabilities on any given day. First of all, in that race, if they had no luck and couldn't get out and they've run second, does that mean that they'll automatically win at their next start? What's to say that they're going to not have that same problem at their next start? So there's no relativity to that at all. But where there is the relativity is all that distance that's covered up until that point, because let's say a horse gets checked at the beginning, is that not more as impacted as a horse that finishes in, or is that just another reason that a rider may give to the owners, trainers, about the non-performance of the horse or not? So we've got to be very careful when we look at that situation. Now, I totally disagree with that particular point in the sense that ultimately it has no relevance to anything at all other than that's what's happened under that circumstances, because there is no guarantee that that will be repeated or not repeated when it steps out next. Yeah. And the race
and the
circumstance can be very different as well.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off. I was going to say the market's pretty good at factoring luck or lack of luck into their next race. Last time I looked, I went through 5 or 6 years of data and, you know, basically whether the horse had been in the steward's report last start or not, and there was no difference in just pure profitability. So not doing the form, but just steward's report yes or steward's report no, there was no difference at all as to their market performance next start. So,
correct.
Yeah.
You're so right, and that makes a lot of sense, David, because it's just no different. Here we go. We had Royal Bessette on the weekend, travelling so much additional ground. Would that be considered to be more disadvantage or less disadvantage of the horse getting checked or blocked in the last 50 metres?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's the answer.
Exactly. So paraphrasing, a jockey is 50-something kilos, a racehorse is 500-something kilos. The jockey isn't big and strong enough to control the horse. That was the end of the quote. Instead, you claim that natural running style dictates where horses settle in races. Let's divide races into three parts. The ramp phase, from the race start to cruising or settling speed. This phase will be of somewhat different duration for each runner, depending on their early race speed. Then there's the plateau phase, the middle section of the race, where the speed of all runners is quite similar. And then the divergence phase, when the speed of individual runners starts to significantly diverge from the pack average. If jockeys can't control their mounts in the ramp phase, in which of the two other phases can jockeys control their mounts in a meaningful way? Or do you see jockeys as being passengers more than drivers?
Well, in some cases they are passengers. When we've got young horses, they're still very inexperienced.
And I can name a few passengers if you want.
Yep. So there's no doubt, I'd be happy for you to do that. So there are situations, there's no doubt, where they do become passengers. And sometimes they become passengers for negative reasons and not positive reasons. But this is a situation largely dictated by a horse. Then we have a situation where there could be specific instructions. The specific instructions is we want this horse to go back, to learn how to settle, but the horse wants to go forward, because it's still learning its craft and therefore creating a number of problems which could have an impact late. And then we have the horses where they're very well mannered and they're willing to do whatever the rider sort of within reason asks it to do based on its capability. Because sometimes when a horse runs out of its capability and it can't do any more, well, that's the end. Or if the horse or the jockey makes errors, I think the jockeys play a massive role in judgment, but the horses also do play a role in terms of their temperament. And this is such a wide variance that one must profile every single horse in its own elements and understand the characteristics and nuances to have an exact answer. So this would not be one that you could just sort of answer with any clarity without going into horse by horse. And this is why profiling horses is critically important.
Definitely. So the second last question is three gut busting or tough runs.
Yes.
What exactly does this refer to? Does three wide without cover in a race with a single turn count as a gut buster? What about two wide racing outside the leader? All horses must undergo a recovery period after a race, and most of this is normally within 1 to 3 days of racing, regardless of how fatigued the horse became during the race, and assuming that it wasn't injured by the run due to being well below race fitness. There is no third category that might be referred to as flattened, where the horse is in a limbo state between extreme but short-term fatigue on one hand to being injured after running with an inadequate for racing fitness level on the other. Please explain how a run couldn't fit into either of those categories but still result in a horse performing well below its best for the remainder of its preparation.
Yes, well, that's a good question. And the reality is there when we sort of sit down and think about this, gut-busting runs, I don't sit there and say, oh, because he's three wide all the way. This is what racing's looked at for years when people study videos. So it was cut wide with no cover. I guess World Descent would have been another perfect example of that on the weekend when it was extremely wide for the majority of the race with no cover and still ran second. Now, would that run be a gut-buster or not? That's the question. And then whether that would have an impact in their future race starts for the rest of the campaign or not. The terminology for me for gut-busting is we could probably bring it back down to the human element and bring some relevance to it. If we're in a situation where we're going to go out and train and perhaps we've just sort of done some very, very light building work for a period of 3 months, 4 months, just to get that skeletal condition into a place where we can handle some pressure, and then we go out and we have a moderate run, let's call that the barrier trial, where we're doing some pre-training work and we're just asked to run 800 metres of a circuit, and just within yourself, no sort of hard pace work, just if you can go 1 minute per 400 metres, that's the race pace we'd like you to go, even though your capabilities might be 50 seconds. So if you do that and you have that performance and then you come out and you run that circuit, now if you run, let's say, that circuit of 1 minute for 400 metres or two laps in 2 minutes, and now all of a sudden what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to come out and we're going to put a pacemaker in place, and all of a sudden you're going to run that first lap 48 seconds, which is actually reaching your absolute maximum capability of your 50 seconds per your each lap. So that means you're now asked to run probably 2 seconds faster than what your pace is for two laps on one lap. What exertion would that have on you on your second lap other than deteriorating time? And secondly, how would you pull up in terms of the stress in terms of your muscles and your body fatigue once that happens? Generally speaking, it would take many, many days to recover from that. And if you have a quick backup into another run, so in other words, that was my first real race that I went into and I've had to exert that much energy. And then if I was asked to come back a week later and run again, not at that same brutal speed, I would most likely feel a lot more lethargic than I would under different circumstances. Now, depending on the extremity, I think there was a situation with Overreach when it came out and won the Blue Diamond that went to 1,400 metres, and I don't have the figures right on the top of my mind right now, but that was amazing speed that went to. It's yet to come back to the races.
He mentioned the
that's extreme pressure.
Yeah.
You know, not only was it well above the benchmark, but it might have been a level that was so far above that sometimes horses never come back. Now, I'm not saying Overreach will never come back, but it may take a lot longer than what it normally did because they can also be gutted and not want to race anymore to push themselves to that extreme.
Yeah. All right, just to finish up then, by dismissing or downplaying the impact of weight carried, jockeys and detrimental race events, I'm going to suggest that you're too interested in keeping your data pristine, a word that you've used yourself in Champion Picks webinars, and not interested enough in tweaking the data to reflect significant real-world variables. Compare your purist philosophy to an example from athletics. Usain Bolt's 100-metre raw time in the London Olympic final was 9.64 seconds. His official time is 9.63 because the raw time was adjusted to account for wind speed and direction. There is no belief in leaving the raw time data untouched in the athletics world. Why don't you take the same approach with racing?
Well, that's a good question. So on a personal level, Of course I would adjust the figures, but I'm not going to do that for others because everyone has their own philosophy and interpretation of what that adjustment should be. So therefore, I like to give it in pristine nature and in its raw format so each individual can use its own brain capacity and capabilities and skill and not rely on others to provide that form. So therefore, we have a lot more intellect in the game, and that doesn't bring you to subjectivity of individuals' situations where they can attack it. So I don't agree with that point. I would have only made the adjustment by half a length and not one length. So why did you make it one length? Why would one even want to enter that element of contest? So I like to keep in the pristine raw nature so each individual can use and exercise their own skill and the brains that they were given, and it's up to their intellect to determine what they should be. Of course, me as an individual, I have many different ways of interpreting, but that's my skill.
Yeah, and regarding Usain Bolt, I haven't researched this, but my understanding was the wind, you know, they have a threshold for wind. So
that's right.
You know, if they've adjusted the time, that would just be, instead of like a raw time, they've got the real time, so that, you know, because they're working with such small amounts. But I thought I didn't think they adjusted the time for wind. They won't recognise a world record if there's a significant...
That's correct.
Yeah.
And that's what they do, and that's very important. So as world records shouldn't be that easily broken. And if they are, they want to make sure it wasn't because it was a tremendous wind assistance, which happens from time to time, and it can be significant over a short course, particularly if the wind's right behind them, make a very big impact at 0.2 or 0.3 in some cases.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure it's binary, as in it's either they'll recognise the time, yep, or if the threshold, if the wind's too strong, they'll say no. So I don't think they adjust it, you know, by 0.02 or 0.03, depending on the strength of the wind, but... I'll be corrected there if I'm incorrect.
That's a fair point, David. And now what we do with the IVRs was actually one of the things that Rick wanted to see right at the beginning. He wanted to see like an adjusted IVR figure for the daily track average, and we do provide that. But ultimately, again, because I like to give it out in their raw natures, because there are just so many variables, and here's the variable. If I feel that the track between the 1,000-metre mark and the 600-metre mark is 5 lengths slow, what should the adjustment be? Now, my interpretation of that could be very different to the next, because he might say, well, hang on, the fence was only 2 lengths disadvantage, and the horse that was 5 wide, he was only 4 lengths disadvantage, and the horse in the middle, he was actually 5. So this opens up very serious interpretation. That's why profiling of every individual horse and making the fine-tuning gives you the ultimate insight to giving you that advantage on race day. Mind you, every race has its own unique characteristics and is irrelevant in many cases to what happened the start before.
Yep. And really, your job's about giving the best, the most accurate and most insightful data around it. It's up to the user to then work out how they're going to, you know, attack an upcoming race with that data.
It is. It's very important. The last thing that I want to do is, first of all, of course, I'm always happy to give my views and opinion if that can help. Certainly don't feel that it's necessary to get involved in debates, but I have a lot of respect for all form students of racing or any other sport that they may study. And I pay a lot of respect to that because it takes time, effort and work. And the last thing I'm going to do is try and insult their intelligence and say, no, this is what it should be. And that's what it is, because people can too quickly get themselves in that framework. I'd rather say, here's the raw data. Look at the videos. You interpret the best way you can. You actually may end up having a better judgment than me. And that's the great part of this game.
Most definitely. Well, that's the end of the cross-examination. Drufus had said that he's a fan of your work, but he wanted to play the devil's advocate, and I think he's done that well.
He has. He's asked some very, very skilled questions, and perhaps in a number of ways I wasn't able to answer some of those points, perhaps in the way he would have liked. And this is, unfortunately, I guess if I was a private guy that no one knew and no one ever spoke to, sometimes you can come out and say things a little bit more easily than other times, because it's just amazing how the world works and how human behaviour may be.
No, I think you've covered it well, and he's exceptionally keen and he's desperate to learn, so there should be more of it. So, we'll leave it there for this week, Vince. I'm sure we'll get you back on again soon enough, and all the very best. Thanks, everyone, for listening in.
Oh, as always, David, thank you so much, and the team at Chance Picks. I love my time.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to Betting 360. Get more in-depth analysis, tips, and that betting edge by heading over to championpicks.com.au, where you'll find a full transcript of this episode. If you like the show, share us with a fellow punter or drop by iTunes to leave us your thoughts. Betting 360, punting from all angles.